The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
The people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Don't buy anything based solely on tip or recommendation you hear. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast, episode 443, and it's a biggie. It's a longie. It's Good Friday tomorrow. Markets are closed for a couple of days, and Monday, of course. So I thought, listen, I'll put together a podcast that's long enough to last all weekend. It's not that long, but it's long. So on the podcast today, I've got James Vaughan, Managing Director of UltimatePlayer.me, which is part of the Ultimate Sports Group, that's USG. He talks about their new free-to-view online platform dedicated to bring children an ability to measure their own individual skill set. A very interesting chat with James, and I like this project so much, I registered while we're chatting. You can hear that for my sons, because I think it's an excellent idea. Also on the podcast, Managing Director of Keras Resources, KRS is ticker, Dave Reeves talks about the progress they're making at their three tribute mines in Australia. Dave was first on the podcast in November. The share price was at 0.4 of a pence. They're now at triple that. I should have listened, you know. I should have listened more carefully. And a lot more potential, I think, to come with Keras. Also on the podcast, Barry Gibb, research analyst with Beaufort Securities, discusses the macro and micro news that could have significant impact on the markets over the next weeks and months. He also mentions the following stocks: London Stock Exchange, Advanced Oncotherapy, Motive Bio, MySquare, and Watkins Jones, WSG, just floated, and he reckons there could be some good upside there. And also, Chief Executive Officer of Edenville Energy, EDL, Rufus Short, answers private investor-submitted questions, and he talks about the progress of their coal-to-power project in Tanzania. Is that enough for you? Oh, by the way, one more thing. You've got about an hour left. Well, I say an hour. No, a couple of hours from now. In fact, 3 hours from now, to enter the Vox Markets Oil Price Sweepstake. Go to voxmarkets.co.uk/OPS. When I say an hour, it obviously it's realised the podcast depends on when you listen. If it's gone 4:30 today, Thursday, then it's shut for the week. All right, it'll open back again next week. But you have to get guesses in before 4:30 today, that's Thursday, and we take the price of Brent crude at midday on Friday. If you're spot on, you win that, plus the rollover from last week. It's been around 40. You win about 80-odd bucks, I expect. So go there, voxmarkets.co.uk/OPS.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
Ultimate Sports Group has a number of investments in sports-focused operations, with its primary focus currently being on UltimatePlayer.me, a new free-to-view online platform dedicated to bringing children an ability to measure their own individual skill sets. UltimatePlayer.me complements the company's established investments in Sports in School subsidiary, which coaches over 20,000 children per week. USG currently has a market cap around 3.8 million, and joining me right now is Managing Director of UltimatePlayer.me, is James Vaughan. James, thanks for joining me, fella.
Hi, Justin. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
For having me.
Yeah, that's great. Well, good to have you on. And I take it you are a big sports fan, yeah?
I am, yes. It's been my whole life, and I've been very fortunate to be able to be involved in now sort of bigger things in sport instead of just playing it. So, really, yeah, been very lucky.
So this is your passion. So tell us about your personal background, James.
So personal background is I've got dyslexia, and I really struggled at school. So if it wasn't for sport, and that sort of guided me in the right way, it was a tough journey for me sort of growing up, but I was very lucky. I was good at tennis, very, very good at tennis. So I sort of pursued a career in tennis and also football. So I was quite a good athlete, football, and then along with tennis and swimming and cricket, all different sports. So, but I sort of went full stream into tennis and played very high level, and but got more into the coaching side of it and started working with the elite players, and then became a strength conditioning coach, and then became a national high performance coach with the LTA.
Okay, so what is Ultimate Player, you know, attempting to do? What is its mission statement, etc.? Fill us in there.
So Ultimate Player, it's I've been 20 years teaching and been involved in the sports industry, and the one thing that's been lacking is being able to have something with technology and connecting with children and with something that they are really They know more about it than us now as adults. And I wanted to get something where we could reach everyone of all levels, all abilities, and to be able to involve them in a complete different side of it. The side that they never get to see, which is the assessment side from coaches. But they get involved in that, and from that they actually become better within the sport. So we tested it out there and put it out there, and it's now gone full stream. So it's been fantastic, amazing journey.
Okay, so how do they do this? What's the actual product of Ultimate Player?
So what happens is all coaches that are ambassadors, that are registered with the Ultimate Player, they are able to use this, the online platform. So after every single session in any sport, children are able to take part in what they do, but they get in assessments done. So it's a simple assessment that's tapped in via a phone, iPad, or on a laptop. And coaches can do it there and then in the session or after the session. And before the kids get home, they have this data sent to them, to their parents and to them, and they are able to log in and have their own online page, similar to the sort of Facebook or Instagram, but it's all promoting healthy living and them wanting to do better in their personal goals in sport.
Yeah, I quite like that, because, you know, everyone likes a bit of, you know, motivation, and I suppose this
definitely
will help. So how does it sort of help the coach then? I mean, does it change the way the coach coaches or not? How does it help them?
No, it doesn't. It just complements what they're doing. And the thing is with coaching, there's obviously coaches who are very experienced. I mean, I've been doing it for 20 years, so it's sort of day-to-day to me now. But there's obviously the next generation of the coaches that are going to be teaching our children are the ones that are the most important now, and they haven't got that 20 years experience. So I wanted to build a product where he could put all coaches on the same level and following the same assessment. It's really fun. It's really exciting. It's really good for them. And it's one of the hardest things is keeping in touch with parents and getting the family cohesion. So kids are fantastic. They understand what they're doing, but a lot of parents get sort of lost. They're just seeing that all they do is pick the kids up from the sessions and then just more like a taxi driver for the kid, but actually really don't understand exactly what they're doing. So it's really key to us to get the parent involved with that child. And it's something we've been testing for 6 years. And like I said, family cohesion is brilliant. Because if you get mum, dad, nan, granddad all involved in what the child's doing, it works brilliant. It just motivates the kid even more to get out there and wanting to do more fitness, more work, and improve on their personal bests and the weaknesses they've got. So, yeah, it's been good. It's been very good.
Yeah, well, do you know what? I know this would be work for my son, because I've got two sons. One is at the stage where he's going swimming lessons and stuff, and he'll come out of the pool, and or my wife will take him, and he'll come back to the house. I say, "How was swimming, Fred? Good?"
Yes.
And literally get one-word answers, you know? What did you do? Did swim in? You know, there's no, and I can't measure, really, apart from if it goes up a grade now and again, but I can't measure, you know, when he's doing it, what he's doing. So I suppose, and is this what? Is it good for what, 4 to 11-year-olds? What is that the age?
Yeah, 4 to 11 is our main target audience, but we've actually been most successful in with sort of year 7 and 8, so going up from sort of 12 to 14 as well in secondary school. I think that's maybe because they've sort of got their own phones and stuff like that, so it's more that they can get it really instant, the feedback, because it's amazing. I mean, like you said with your son, he goes to swimming, and it's amazing how while you're swimming at the end of that session you can get on your phone and actually see your son's, how he's improved, you know, his breaststroke, his front crawl, and also have a look at the stuff that he needs to improve on. And it's amazing how kids start working on their weaknesses, because they see it's a game. They start as an amateur, they want to get to the ultimate player, that goes amateur, semi-pro, professional, world-class ultimate player. Like any computer game they've done, we've built it around that. We've built it what they love. They love their computer games. We all love games where if there's a level, you want to try and get to the top. But what we've done is to encourage them to do it about themselves and not play on a computer and worry about making these avatars great. We want to push them out there on the field or in the pool or on the court to get them to think about their personal best, wanting to complete the game for themselves. And, you know, we're not looking for the next David Beckham. We're not looking for the next Serena Williams or any of these guys. We're just looking to be able to give a really positive and where kids can maybe take control of themselves and you know, not so much a coach has to be feed this information all the time, that they actually take more responsibility of it.
Well, do you know what? Gamifying, you know, self-improvement like this and sport is excellent, I think. Because, do you know what? A couple of years back, I turned 40 and I put on a bit of weight and I decided to get running. And I was just toodling along and I wanted to lose weight. And then I got an app, you know, I think it was a Nike app or something like that, and for running, you know, or Runkeeper, one of those apps. And it improved my performance so much because I knew exactly how fast I was supposed to be going. And I sort of hit the targets I'd set. And so without this kind of gamifying situation, I probably wouldn't have done so well, you know. And I did a couple of half marathons. And it does help, you know. Because it's completely objective, you know, it's a machine, essentially, it's data. You can't argue with it. And,
That's exactly it.
Yeah, and so it's not someone just telling you, you need to go faster. It's the machine just, you know, measuring how your ability is and how you've improved, sort
Correct.
Of, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, analytics in our life are happening all the time. And I think a lot of the time we don't. But now there's so many brilliant gadgets out there, especially for the adult market, with all these apps, with the running apps and, health apps and stuff. And we're quite familiar with those now, but we've built something unique. It's the first product that's out there for children to use to get them engaged in the stuff they're doing with amazing, you know, coaches are very sort of underlooked. You know, it's like teachers now. You know, back in the day, they were some really important people, but now they're very overlooked teachers and stuff, and they do the most amazing job. And this complements them with the work they're doing already, but in such a quick, easy way, so they can get it over to the parents, so the parents can actually see value for what they're doing. We used to have to always sit there and write loads of reports, and just at the end of the year, and we're that, you know, this is something that we can do after every single session. So yeah. It's good.
And I suppose what it's also good with is you've got a coach there teaching 10 people, then essentially, if they haven't got an app or something, they are sort of almost judging every kid on a certain level, almost to the best guy in the class and the worst guy in the class. But with apps, you can judge against yourself, your own
exactly
self-improvement,
that, yes.
rather than having to judge against another people's self-improvement. And as we all know, you know, everyone's of different ability. And so in apps, I suppose it would help with this ultimate player. So how does it work? Is it free to join? What happens?
It's free to join. It was something that we've have been very successful with, been able to build the model around that. It's free for coaches to join, it's free for children to join, free for parents to join. And what we want to do is be able to, these hurdles that can always get in the way of these amazing products, I wanted to make it exclusive to everyone, regardless of background or where they're from. We want it to be something that everyone can get hold of. And obviously it is a lot easier, you know. It's the most important thing we wanted to make sure, though, it was safe. We've invested a lot of time and a lot of money in terms of the safe side of the security online. So
yeah, So mention the safety. I can imagine people saying, "Oh, you know, app kids go on the internet and all this stuff." But there's this tag system, isn't there? Can you explain
yes.
that?
Well, it's fantastic because the product itself, when I first built it, it actually got pulled to pieces by the kids, and we had over 200 focus groups just with the children in terms of what they were looking for. We've had over 600 focus groups in terms of the whole community, in terms of coaches, parents, and kids, but. When I actually put it up, it was something that the hurdle we had to jump over, which was we can't have personal information. We didn't want personal information of children on online. We didn't want that. But how could we get it across for kids to be engaged, to know who they were and what they were doing? But it was actually one of the children who created what they call their tag. And it's same as any sort of coat of arms or like the Arsenal badge or the Chelsea badge in football. They were more interested in being able to design and build their own identity through using the tag builder. So we looked into it and we built it, and it's just been crazy. They can have these tags that they build their own identity onto, hoodies and hats and stuff like that. But also, of course, it hides the identity of the child. Funny enough, one of the children who's actually at the top of the leaderboard in terms of the actual whole program, which only we get to see, has got Downs. And it's fantastic because we've got children with learning difficulties or any visual problems that they might have, or any disabled children. Everyone's on the same platform. And so they're able to, because they're all hidden behind this identity, so no one gets to see who they are, what they're doing. And obviously, the personal best thing is key for us. So they're only assessed on their level. And it was a brilliant feature that Baker was able for us to be able to really get this product out there. And the kids love it. You know, it's hugely creative. They get to go on and build their tags and stuff. So it helps with that sort of stuff. And along with the numbers, with the stats, schools are using it in their technology classes, but also in maths lessons now.
Yeah, well, do you know what's good is that you've had so much feedback from, you know, the children, because it's not like you've created something you think they will like. It's
yes.
something that they know they will like and use. And like, you know, tag, which is quite street cred. It comes from, a graffiti artist tagging
yeah,
their work, so that's quite cool. All right, so you say it's free. How does it make money then?
So the monetizing, I mean, what we're looking to at the moment, we're expanding at a rate of knots. With obviously with it being free, we're able to go and alert the governing bodies, and they can see that we are really trying to make an effort without having to go to them and asking them for any funding and stuff. And these are always the big problems. So we can get a lot of coaches and a lot of children on board very quickly. It was what part of the focus groups, actually, there was a huge demand for parents who said that this was such a positive product. Instead of them purchasing stuff on all their computer games, which probably weren't great, and they were spending a lot of money on these things, the in-app purchase was a key thing. And because it was more, especially on the tag builder, there was a part of that where they can actually have upgrades. We have three packages. We have a bronze, silver, and gold, which are from £15, £25, up to £40. And already we've started to see people wanting. We did have focus groups, and we wanted to test that to see if there was a something that they were going to be interested in. And it was really positive. So we had over 5% of our people straight away wanting to buy these online purchases. And we also have our own merchandise that we use. And obviously with the tag builder, they can pull their tags on, and the brand itself has really taken off. Yeah. We're taking lots of orders with the clothing. So there isn't really cool stuff out there that the kids have created themselves. The big brands are fantastic at doing stuff, but it's the same thing every year. Now we've left it in the hands of the children to be able to create it. And of course, they've got, you know, their own personal part of the actual product itself. It's like it's this customization is key. And they get to control the whole product themselves, and it's about recognizing their achievements along on their stuff. So it's really exciting. Yeah, so we've been it's a big part of our way we're going to be making some money on this, but also obviously there's stuff with partnerships, advertising, and sponsorships, because a lot of people and a lot of organizations want to be recognized, but you're really making a difference now and getting kids to be more active and out there. So yeah, it's really
But listen, who doesn't want to be in front of children, you know, products, and, you know, because they are, listen, I've got two kids, I know how much money gets spent on kids, and how many stuff they want to buy, what toys they want, you know, so all this kind of stuff. So I know there are lots of people out there who'd like to advertise in front of children, and also they can be, you know, really appropriate for this kind of niche of getting fit and all that. So,
I mean, we have our awards. I mean, the big, big thing for us is to be able to give these children awards, and the coaches now with the product, we can give awards instantly. And it's like, you know, your son did the swimming. Now every parent knows that once they've done achieved something, they've normally got the 5 meter badge that they pay £3.50 for, and the 20 meter badge. And it's just a common thing where when children are doing well and achieving well, the parents will, they'll dip into their pockets to recognize that achievement. Now we have all that online, and you know, it's the future of the stuff they can build. So we have our own trophy cabinet that the kids have on their own page, and they love awards. And this is something that for the coach, they don't have to pay anything, but so they can give as many as they want for all different reasons. And that's what's incentivizing these children, because they're getting recognized for the stuff they're doing. So it's fantastic. And then the parents do feel they want, you know, they want to recognize how well they've done. So they will buy these in-app purchases and the products that we provide. It's something that they requested through the focus group. So we had to put it in.
Yeah. So how much, you know, did it cost to build the site?
So currently we've invested over £1 million into the whole product in terms of from the beginning, from when we were first designing it right through to the security and the lawyers and so on, and right down to now where it's actually in the children's hands. It's being used as we speak. You know, we've currently inputted nearly 52,000 results from the children we have. And we've had over 8,000 awards being given to them, and that's only in our first 10 weeks. So it's really taken off. We're constantly with meetings with new organizations. We're taking on about 4 or 5 a day, and it's fantastic. It's really exciting, and we've had no negative feedback because, again, people have seen that we spent a long time on this. And you know, when you go to these meetings, they're ready to sort of pull it to pieces, but they've you know, really appreciate the time and effort we spent on this. And they don't ask questions at the end because we've answered it all for them within the product. It's been in the right hands, you know, from the very best coaches in the country to the very best Ofsted inspectors or parents. So it's really nice. It's really good.
So how long have you been, three questions in 1 year. So how long have you been going? How many people registered? And what are your targets for people registering?
So currently at the moment, I mean, we've been, like I said, we went for our testing period, and I was been very fortunate to be able to do that. I was built a small product that we put out there and tried it out, and this is how the whole journey started. It was based on, similar to the match attacks, the little football cards that the children get where Ronaldo's
I know about those, yeah.
Messi and Ronaldo, you know, it's all about their speed and their shooting. And I thought, why can't I design something where it's all about them, you know, if it's a swimmer or if it's a footballer, and they concentrate on themselves and wanting to improve their stats. And that's where the idea came from. And I was able to try that out and do it. So we put that through the testing for 6 years. Then we started the build. So that's been taken over probably sort of 2 years, and it's been very, very hard, but amazing to go through that journey of working with so many amazing people. From definitely something out of my comfort zone is working with coders and designers in the sort of technology world. And then going and meeting all these amazing people who have invested in it and believe in this is what needs to be done. You know, we have built something for the next generation that probably not even born yet, but it's fantastic. And what we're looking to do is, at the moment, we really want to keep it controlled. You know, we're still going for the stage where we're it's fantastic because we get to see these we're meeting all the coaches themselves, and still it's fantastic because we're getting a lot of feedback. But like I said, it's all positive, so we might be doing small tweaks to make it better. But we're taking on, at the moment, we've got nearly 150 coaches. Like I said, from our real launch, that was in from December. We've got over 6,000 children on the program, and it's moving very, very well at the moment. We're taking on, like I said, in after Easter, I think we've got another 4,000 children starting. So at the moment, it's just making sure that we still provide such a quality service to the people actually getting involved. And then we're looking to go, obviously, national. And obviously the future, what we're looking to, this has been built so we can take it overseas. And we've had more interest in the product itself, funny enough, in China and America. China obviously really trying to push their the football out there and their sports. They do an amazing programs out there. But again, it's this, no one's capturing the actual hard work they're doing. And what this does with the analytics, it's capturing all the stuff. So I could say to you today, in 7 weeks, you know, we already captured 42,000 results. In 10 weeks, we got 52,000. You know, these are big numbers that we're able to capture. And when you're going to these organizations or governing bodies, they listen, you know, and we've got the data to back it up. You know, we build it in the system. So organizations that are doing amazing jobs, we can actually give them that data now. So and it's helping them, supporting them with the great work they're doing. There's, you know, a lot of stuff we do. And do we really record it? It's like the fitness stuff, you know. Now we've got watches and stuff that can literally find out, track everything we're doing, how many steps, and then it makes you think about it a little bit more in terms of, especially when it comes to your food and stuff. So,
How do you get the product out there? Do you approach schools or what?
Yeah, at the moment we've just currently going through a big sort of how we're going to advertise it and put it out there, and we're doing it really well. But the social networking sites have been key to us. LinkedIn is huge. The Facebook, obviously. The communities in the sort of sporting world with parents, not so much children, because obviously the children are still at that age where they're not quite there yet. But for us, we've got to reach the parents, and parents are on those. And the Ultimate Player brand already, because again, parents have looked into it and seen it, and they've seen that it's a fantastic product, and we've ticked all the boxes in terms of the safety and so on. They're very comfortable with it, so we're starting to really push it out there. And if anything, it's more spreading by word of mouth. But we've got a really big push in terms of how we're going to advertise, and it's really exciting. But we do need to make sure that our infrastructure behind the scenes is all set up, and we've done that now. So really good times ahead. Looking forward to it.
Marvellous. So let's say me now, I want my son involved in this, right? How do I go about getting me on? Is it just a case of me registering, or what happens there?
Yeah, so you go onto the site, www.ultimateplayer.me. It's very clear. You can go to the top of the toolbar at the top, and it's got
I can see the thing that it's got. Yeah, shop, yeah. Coaches, parents, contact, login.
That's
yeah,
it. So it's so really simple. So a parent goes to the parent, the coach goes to the coach. So what we do have a lot of children where parents will register and register interest, so we can start seeing that demand. And then what we want to do is we like to find out exactly where they're from and what they're doing, and that helps us approach these ambassadors and getting these guys all qualified, so we can say that your nearest place to be able to be a part of the program you can do. But it's good as well because we get to the school. So it's funny enough, it's parents are leading a lot of the stuff because they are interested. And then when you're approaching organizations or schools to say, look, the children have been asking to do this, they listen because it's getting us through the door. So they're sort of doing the sales pitch for us, which is really good. So, but most of our stuff are done for our ambassadors. So it's coaches signing up and adding their children to it. So all the coaches out there, or teachers or youth group leaders that are doing amazing jobs, they're registering, we're approaching them, or they're registering to us, and then they put their children that they've already got. So for Ultimate Player, it's brilliant because we're not having to go out and find these children. The coaches are doing it, and they're adding the children for us. So we're building this market of children that are getting this brilliant product, coaches are getting this brilliant product, and it's getting to the parents. But it's being built for us by people that have already got all the children, instead of us sort of trying to find those children. And schools, yes, you know, schools are fantastic because they love more the side of it in terms of the data and the analytics and the maths. When you get children involved in charts and looking at numbers, they think we're some sort of genius. So, which we have, we've got 4-year-olds who can work out what they're going to get in the next few weeks if they average this or they average that, which is quite good. It definitely seems like they've been speaking to the parents, which that's what we want. We want the parents involved more.
Well, listen, I am involved. I've just registered now as a parent while you were talking there. So I like it. You know, I'm sold. I love the idea. And of anything to get to, because it strikes me that I, you know, I'll get more communication out of this website than I will my son. So,
yes.
Yeah, so I've registered. So I've gone to ultimateplayer.me and just click the parent. If you're a parent, if you're a coach, click that. And then you'll be sending an email confirming that. And you'll
take it
from there.
We've just got it now. It's just come through. So we'll have Sophie, our head of operations. We'll get in touch with you and make sure you can see. So we'll take you through to the next part of the journey.
Marvellous.
Very exciting for yourself.
Yeah, cool. James, lovely to talk to you, and hopefully you can come on again when you have some further news.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Managing Director of Keras Group, and that's KRS ticker, and that's Dave Reeves. Dave, thanks for coming back on.
Always a pleasure, Justin.
Listen, it's the third time on you. You're almost like a regular. And I was looking at your share price, and I looked at it from when you started coming on, back in almost the start of November last year. That was pretty much at a low, and I was thinking, do you know what? I should have bought some stock in that. Because you were, point, almost just below 0.4 of a penny. And now the share price today is at, I'm looking at delayed price, but it was 1.1, and it's probably a bit higher today. So, I'd have tripled my money there if I'd started and actually, you know, bought a bit of stock there. So are you quite happy with the share price performance so far?
I think it goes without saying that, yeah, I'm very happy with how it's gone. And, you know, yes, we were certainly at a low in November. Shame you didn't buy then. We just changed strategy. We'd just announced the gold acquisition. So it makes sense that we're at a low. And, you know, in the intervening 4 months, we've been very busy and have just started digging ore. So, you know, I think it's very understandable why the share price has gone where it has. And, you know, I hope there's more upside there. I believe there should be. Based on some, you know, pretty reasonable fundamentals.
Yeah, well, listen, I had a lot more interest now on, and a lot of people approach me saying, get Dave from Keras on. I don't know if they've heard the previous podcast, but I said, he's on tomorrow, and this was yesterday. And they said, great stuff. But listen, for people, obviously there's a lot of people now out there aware of Keras, but can you tell us, for people who, you know, are not aware of your company, can you tell us exactly what you're doing, please, Dave?
For sure. So our main focus is on gold mining in Australia. We have three tribute mining projects down here. So a tribute mining arrangement is slightly unusual in that other people own the leases and the resources. We come in and mine them and have them processed. And for that, we pay them a royalty, a percentage of what we earn, or a profit share basis. So the real advantage of a tribute, I think, is in black and white for all to see, in that in 4 months, we've gone from nothing to first gold digging on the back of a $500,000 loan facility. So it means you don't do any of the expensive exploration. You know, all the permits are in place. We use toll mills. So from a capital perspective, it's essentially zero. It's just working capital to get these things going. And then you're into production, cash production. Maybe not, you know, quite as high as, well, it's not quite as high as you would be if you owned it 100%. But you're not putting in any capital. So your return on your own money invested is, you know, substantial.
Yeah, I was reading about this, because of course, and the people you've struck up deals with, I suppose there can be several reasons. In a downturn in commodities, they've put a lot of capital down there, and for some reason, they don't want to put any more capital down, do they? And when the commodity's at a low level, and then so you come in, it's sort of mutually beneficial, I suppose, isn't it?
Oh, look, it certainly is a win-win, and each of the parties we're dealing with are very different. Our first and main tribute is with Norton Goldfields. You know, Norton's part of Zijin Mining, which is one of the largest gold miners in the world. And in that case, you know, they've got a very large mill with very large pits and very large equipment. And there's a lot of very small deposits still lying around that just take up too much time and effort for them, and their gear's too big. So we come in and use smaller kit and take those smaller deposits, and then they can process that through their mill. So it frees up their time to concentrate on the bigger picture, which is their bigger pits. But what it allows for us is, you know, some pretty steady state production, and in particular access to deposits like the ultra high grade Prince of Wales Underground.
Yeah, so you have now, what, three tribute mines, don't you? And are they all in the same area of Australia there?
Yeah, they are. So it's a pretty unique area in world mining. I was just chatting to someone today just about the infrastructure. So, you know, Kalgoorlie's 600 kilometres east of Perth. It's a major mining centre. It's one of the two main gold rush areas of Australia from the 1800s and has been in continuous production ever since, and is one of the most prolific gold belts in the world. Within, let's say, 100 kilometres of Kalgoorlie, there must be eight or nine gold mills turning away, some of them full, some of them not full. To get to our site, we drive on bitumen roads all the way until the last 5 kilometres, where we drive on a public all-weather dirt road before turning off the last sort of kilometre onto private haul roads. We've got power to the Prince of Wales site, you know, power lines in there. All the infrastructure's established. You've got all the suppliers in Kalgoorlie, all the contractors, surveyors, you name it, it's there. So from an infrastructure point of view, it really is just a wonderful place to operate.
Yeah, and I was looking, so your market cap is around about, what, 13 million, I think, pounds. And you also have, I mean, assets, don't you, in West Africa?
Yeah, we do. So we originally started off with iron ore and manganese in Africa. You know, obviously iron ore has really hit the doldrums lately. Manganese has had a roaring month and has actually doubled in value in the last month, and is back to where it was sort of 2.5 years ago. So, you know, it's certainly not forgotten. I'm probably heading to Togo in April to see where we are with the mining permit. We need that, but that's again a very low cost operation to bring in that just generates, especially at these prices we're seeing today, a hell of a lot of cash flow.
Yeah. So you say we're going to be in production when?
Okay, the manganese, we still need a mining permit, and we will only go into production when we are happy with where we are in gold. We're a small team, limited amount of time, and we've got a hell of a lot on our plate with gold. But manganese is something that we'll look at as and when permits are in place and we're happy with how gold is.
Yeah, so I mean, on the gold in Australia Day, is it second half of this year?
No, we're mining ore. We mined our first ore last week. So again, under the tribute agreement, I know everyone would love to see me holding a gold bar, and I do like to hold gold bars. They're very nice.
Yeah, who
to
doesn't?
But what we do is we mine our ore and we stockpile it by the mine. Okay. Paddington then comes along, picks it up in big road trains, 100-ton trucks, takes it off to the mill. When we have what we call a batch up there, which is a minimum of 3,000 tonnes from an ore block area, we can say, right, that's our parcel of ore, you can start treating that. And then they just blend that into their mill. They do a lot of sampling on the side through a specialised sampling plant, so we all agree the grade, and they mill it. And then there's payment terms of just over a month from when we deliver that ore onto the pad, and we get money into our bank account. So, you know, at what point do you say we're in production? Well, we're mining ore. I suppose the real stage is when we deliver that first parcel, because then it's just time ticking until we get that first check.
Yeah, so when is that first parcel? Did you say the first parcel has been there yet or not?
No, first parcel will be next week. We announced that in our last RNS when we announced the ore mining, so we'll be shipping that next week.
Wow, so, and And so how much is this, these three tubes, and it's hard to put it into, because they all the grades are different stuff, I suppose, and the resources differ, but what's this worth to you? I mean, and how long, what's the period of time, can you, you know, the life expectancy of these mines?
Yeah, look, yeah, very, very tricky to answer simply. Some of the deposits like Prince of Wales will be going as long as we keep the tribute going. For the moment, that's a five-year tribute. And the ore body there supports 5 years. A lot of these other pits, we go in and out of for 3 or 4 months, 6 months, and we just move from pit to pit to pit. But yeah. What we're aiming for in year one is 20 to 30,000 ounces, year two, 30 to 40,000 ounces. So if we take 30,000 ounces per annum, mm-hmm. and we've gone out and said post-royalties, our production cost is around 1,200 Aussie an ounce. You know, at the moment, gold was this week averaging around 1,650 Aussie. You know, that's about $450. So, I don't know, that's close to 14 million Aussie a year in free cash flow. So that's about 7.5 million quid. Market cap's 13 now. And, you know, we hope to add to that story over the coming months. And, yeah, in a perfect world, we'd love to see ourselves, you know, north of 50,000 ounces a year, but we'd need to get additional assets to do that.
Yeah, but are you, you know, once obviously the cash flow comes in, it makes it easy to do that, I suppose, and are you always on the lookout?
Yeah, we always are. There's the goldfields has just got so many people operating, so many opportunities. It's a matter of sifting through them and seeing what works. You know, we're after deposits that are pretty well drilled out on mining leases, near mills with capacity. If it has all of that and we think it makes, you know, a reasonable margin, then, you know, we're keen to have a crack at that.
Yeah, but, it's, you know, it's almost like you this is a good model, isn't it, for you? Would you see this going forward being run alongside eventually the assets in Africa, or would you stop tribute mining and go to Africa, or what?
Oh, look, I think at the moment there's no better place to be than Australian gold. You've got very high gold price, very low input costs. You've got labour, fuel, all those sorts of things at rock bottom because of the mining downturn. So your margins are wonderful. And we see that there's a real opportunity to grow here. So that's where our main growth will be. And as and when we will look back at Africa to, in particular, manganese. You know, when it makes sense and when we've got the permit, bring that into production and add to that cash flow. So it's really all about maximising cash cash flow in the short term, in the next 2 to 3 years, and, you know, trying to grow that.
Yeah, okay. And so what's the next sort of bit of news, you know, we can look out for?
Oh, I think obviously we'll report on when we close off that first parcel of ore to Paddington. We'll keep everyone updated with how we're moving along with our mining. You know, if and when we bring in additional ground to tributes, etc., that I think would be newsworthy. We will be doing studies on our latest tribute area, Lindsay's, and as we finish those studies and understand what it means, you know, for in-pit reserves and underground, we'll announce that. When we start up production there, there'll be announcements there. So it's, I see a really steady flow of news, maybe not every week, but certainly every 2 or 3 weeks, we should have something pretty good coming out for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, and you've been moving quite fast, haven't you? So I suppose, you know, there won't be any lack of news. So, yeah, you've certainly, like I say, even from November, you know, you've moved on quickly, and the share price has reflected that, which is nice to see. Okay, Dave, brilliant stuff. Listen, you know, for anyone that needs any more convincing on Keras there, you know, can you give us three reasons why an investor should put you on their watch list?
I think because we have or are just starting production, that will be number one. Number two, I think we've shown the ability to grow quite rapidly, and we intend to continue to pursue such growth plans. Number three, I think you've got a very good management team based down here, you know, that's proven themselves. To bring something in this quickly is pretty phenomenal. You know, you think about how many years it takes people to normally bring in, how many hundreds of millions of dollars it takes people to bring in gold mines. So, you know, it's been a pretty phenomenal effort in that regard. And then there is the upside and the other assets as and when. So
yeah,
those would be some of the reasons.
Yeah, that's 4 points. So I can give you two more. I mean, because I know this because someone has tweeted me quite a few times saying you are, like you mentioned, in a prolific, you know, gold belt there, which one of the, you know, most prolific in the world. And fifthly, there, don't you have skin in the game here. You own stock, don't you?
Yeah. Look, the board and management are the largest shareholders. We've participated at every round of financing, in the good, the bad, and the ugly, and put a lot of the money in for the loan to get us up and running. So we are firmly leveraged to the performance of the company. That's what drives us. And yeah, so certainly we are very well aligned with shareholders, probably more so than a lot of companies out there, I would suggest.
Marvellous. Dave, listen, I know it won't be long before you'll have some more news. So, you know, come back on and update this.
Certainly shall. Good on you, Justin. Thanks very much.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Barry Gibb, research analyst from Beaufort Securities. Barry, haven't spoken to you for a month because you've been busy, I've been busy, but a lot has happened in a month, hasn't it?
Oh, you bet. A lot has happened. There's no doubt about that. And in fact, I was thinking, to go back 1 month, it's an awful lot has happened. It's in fact a sea change. I mean, looking at it, what happened? It was 4 weeks ago since we spoke, and I think markets bottomed out just before we last met on Vox. Sentiment really swung very sharply indeed for the main indices to find themselves back roughly at, or even slightly over for the S&P, where they started the year. So it looks to some like it was all a bit of a phony war.
This is looking like a bit of a stumbling block now. I've got a line on on the FTSE chart, 6200, and it's banged his head on that several times, and it's not made any convincing stride across that. It's got a couple of points above it, but it seems to be banging his head and then refusing to go any further, you know? I mean, let's have it, you know, has anything changed in the global markets since we last chatted?
Well, I don't know that. I mean, what has changed? I mean, as I say, it looked like a bit of a phony war. We were back to where we started. Although the reality is that a series of what, to all intents and purposes, appear to have been concerted actions by the majors all fell into place. Now, remember the format for this. There were three separate runners behind it, all neatly passing the baton one to the other in turn. And as we said before, China and OPEC started the rout, so they had to be the ones that kicked off the repair work. Now, what did China do? They put their shoulder behind the yuan, they loosened credit conditions and pumped in liquidity big time. Number one, big tick. OPEC then proposed a production freeze, which even attempted to ensnare Nigeria and the UAE at last weekend's talks. And then, of course, last, most certainly not least, the ECB president, Mr. Draghi, Super Mario. He armed himself with a cannonball of measures this time to wow the markets, rather than just using the pea shooter he had back in December. So we got the feel-good factor back. The yuan rallied, oil breached our own target range. Remember where we were? We were 27.35. It went straight through that. In fact, shortly after we spoke last, and then it pushed beyond $40. And there have been various Chinese-driven measures that have pushed iron ore and copper further and further. Markets effectively are now becalmed. Sentiment is still looking on the upside, although relatively low volumes. I think that's one of the keys behind this. Now, it's been enough altogether for the S&P to test its 2016 high, and very importantly also the VIX to plumb back to lows we haven't seen since last summer. And I think underlying all of this is one thing. Traders still see strong credit growth in China, and that convinces them that an imminent rebound in the production growth data, which reported nastily unpleasant lows in February, will be repaired for March. So that's where we're standing right now.
Yeah, well, you wouldn't think it. You know, it seems to be a bit bullish at the moment. But, you know, looking at today's stock market, you wouldn't think it. But so what could, you know, spoil this, you know, otherwise sort of, I suppose, change in sentiment? Because it's become a bit more bullish. But what could spoil that?
What could spoil the picture? Well, where do we start? There's a long list. Well, look, let's just summarise it. The trading pattern of the past 4 weeks reflects a classic short squeeze, with bearish bets being rapidly unwound via cash purchases of stocks and commodities. And this, of course, is what's fueled the spike in asset prices. So I suppose the real question should be, who will next pick up the baton? Or, woe betide, will it even be dropped? Who knows? Whatever. Always expect markets to overshoot. That's both on the downside and back up again. And even if the central scare of a US recession and deflation appears now to have evaporated, the core international problems, and there's a long list, that's global imbalance, that's slowing growth, negative interest rates, subpar inflation, threat of emerging market corporate debt, that's one of our particular bell ringers at this end, they haven't gone away. So what the markets really need now is a further injection of adrenaline to keep their various plates spinning. And then we look, well, last week there was a very crowded central bank agenda, and it certainly did not provide that medicine. The Fed continues to avoid the limelight. I mean, Mrs. Janet Yellen left rates unchanged following her two-day meeting, and this was despite stronger labor market data, with inflation ticking up to 2.3%, and obviously, clearly, to anybody can see there is further pressure behind, which altogether, that should really be enough to justify at least a 25 basis points rise. We didn't get it. Instead, she's playing along with Japan. They're both deferring action until they are convinced of perceptible improvement, or not, as it might be, within the global trading blocks. Whatever. The bottom line from our angle is that the Fed will not risk an inflationary pickup getting out of control for very long at all. So some form of monetary tightening should be expected from the Fed before we get to Q3. So that's one part of the picture. The next, we really should revisit oil. Brent, as you probably saw, temporarily dipped below the psychologically important $40 level when it heard that Iran had reversed its previous position with OPEC, saying that it planned to plug the gap being created by falling US output with an extra 1 million barrels a day of oil equivalent from its own production. And that would take its total to 4 million barrels a day in total. And that's, we have fighting talk from the Saudis on, well, it was on Tuesday we got that. But truthfully, unless Iran is bought rapidly back to heel, it could unhinge the OPEC freeze negotiations, and that meeting's due to take place on April the 17th. So that's one worry, and we're keeping our fingers crossed that that will remain firm, and the OPEC players will all be part of the team, all pulling in one direction. And meanwhile, of course, we've had an unexpected rise in US shale rigs following three straight months of declines, together with US stockpiles reportedly climbing to their highest level since December. So already we've got oil threatening to breach the big figure again. So that's the second worry. Traders are also telling me that they don't think Mr. Draghi's remedies are in fact capable of achieving his all-important 2% inflation goal. Now, it's all quite technical, their argument, but consensus appears to believe that his actions should have included a widening of the spread between short and long-term interest rates in order to effectively steepen the yield curve. Well, that's a sensible stuff for the bond traders to say. Maybe he could have achieved this by cutting deeper into deposit rates while also reducing the size of his asset purchase. I don't know, but the trouble is flat yield curves, of course, are a tricky place to be. The banks are being forced in with a flat yield curve to create long-term loans from short-term savings, for which they get virtually no return. So this simply is not capable of providing the impulsion needed to excite prices closer to his target range. And I think this is what the bond traders are really trying to point at. The blatant reality, and it comes from our bond floor, for example, is that investors who remain willing to buy sub 1% long-term corporate bonds are clearly telling Mr. Draghi that they think he's lost the plot on inflation. And if they are right, then he'll be forced to think again. There's no doubt about that. And then, of course, we have two very, very serious threats looming. And you know what they are. Firstly, we've got Brexit. Mm-hmm. If Brexit takes place, the European project itself could be sharply put into reverse. And secondly, the battle lines for the US presidency are nearly drawn. And there, all bets are being placed on Clinton versus Trump. Now, if Western democracy itself is on trial, can we really expect investors to keep their money on the table throughout the whole proceedings? The answer is probably not. So the list of what can go wrong remains long and frightening. And I think under such circumstances, I always look at gold. Gold, of course, is the investment of last resort, and it has not taken part in the correction of the past few weeks. In fact, it's demonstrated its biggest quarterly gain since 1986, and that tells you there is a large quarter of the investment community who says they've got this on board and they're taking defense already. They're hiding undercover right now. Now, given that U.S. equities presently trade at about 18.1 times earnings, remember, that's higher than it was in the year preceding the financial crisis, well, it won't take too much to set off a correction. So I suppose the overall message is what can go wrong? An awful lot. And the thing to say beyond that is stand by for another test of the financial system. I do think that if the People's Bank of China permits a significant weakening of the yuan, international markets may have found some additional breathing space. Maybe that's where the fourth baton is picked up. It's going to take an awful lot, though. But it is important that we see something on this. Otherwise, we're going to have to face up to the looming Chinese debt crisis sooner rather than later. And I think economics-wise, all said and done, the present reality is you can run, but you can't hide.
Yeah, well, that's a macro, and most investors have no control over that. We sort of sit there and see how it unfolds. But, I mean, you know, what can UK investors do about this? What can they put in their control?
Oh, that's tricky. I would say, firstly, you know, it's worth just summarising, because it was a big event, of course, so the UK budget. It was a series of micro-manoeuvres which provided little new for us domestically or even the internationals. I mean, what did we have? We had spending cuts, corporate tax moves, they were well leaked. Actions to encourage younger people into ISAs and the OBR's downward revision of growth, again, well leaked. There were no giveaways for North Sea explorers, given Westminster's blatant determination to rebuff Mrs. Sturgeon. Nothing new there. And then we had that minor stamp duty concession on, well, for people moving from one principal residence to another. It was only a move of 18 months to 36 months. It was welcome, but as far as we're concerned, it wasn't enough. So I can say that we as a house are genuinely concerned that there could be another hiccup in residential real estate activity, which is worrying because, of course, that is extremely significant for the overall UK economy and consumer sentiment in general. I think something else I would point out to investors who have got 10 minutes on the computer to spare, I think I would recommend that they carefully read this morning's full year statement from Next PLC. The chief executive, he has a reputation of coming out with upfront, straight-talking comments and guidance. This year, he's been quite clear. The UK economy, as far as he's concerned, is slowing, and consumers are headed for a very tough year, 2016. If you look on the prices right now, I think Next PLC, which is a real bellwether of quality in the UK, well, it's down 15%. That tells
me. Yeah, well, I was looking at that 16% at one point. It's back up for 50. Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think the other thing beyond this is this tough year. Whether the June the 23rd vote is one of the causes behind it, we can't actually say. But investors certainly should have Brexit in focus. There will remain opportunities to trade volatility for people who want to be quick in and quick out, but major investors will likely delay their larger strategic decisions for the next couple of months. The UK markets have not managed yet to decouple from the world indices. As I mentioned, I think last time I was on Vox, UK blue chip indices continue to demonstrate remarkable correlation with the MSCI MSCI World Index. I think it's about an 85% correlation. And when I looked at the long-term charts, I could only see it breaking three times since the year 2000. Now, if opinion polls and bookies report a decisive swing to the Leave camp as we get into May, then I think that's the point when the FTSE 100, maybe the 250 as well, but certainly the 100, will decouple and fall sharply to the downside. You should not expect major investors to take big bets until that point has been passed. And just to put it into perspective, our vision is confirmation of Brexit, or shall we say deep anticipation of it, immediately prior to the vote could result in a knee-jerk reaction. And we're talking 15% further for equities and maybe a further 10% for sterling. And of course, if you've got illiquid or smaller issues, your spreads will widen out dramatically as well. So uncomfortable. Right now, the polls seem to have stayed hovering at about 44% in the stay camp and 41% in the leave camp, although possibly more accurate are the prices coming from IG Index and the various bookies, who lifted their own Brexit opportunity to 37.5%, and that's the highest we've ever seen, immediately following those horrendous, truly horrendous events in Brussels 2 days ago. And what you can say within this, at least 15% of the voters still have to make up their minds, so there genuinely is everything to play for. The calmer environment has partially reversed the dramatic falls we saw in sterling during January and February. In this respect, Beaufort's own position, just so as you know how we stand, is that sense will prevail. Generally, the UK public, when it's faced with uncertainty or confusion, takes the safety first choice, which means they will reject Brexit. That's what we believe. Confirmation of this should then herald quite a party for both UK, European shares, sterling and the euro. And of course, that will be largely at the expense of the US dollar. So for those who want to play their hand on this, they could be well rewarded if they guess right. And quite honestly, it is a guess right now. It's a toss of a coin. Now, if we then take a look across the pond, even though we recognize that protest politics in the form of Mr. Donald Trump has certainly captured most of the US soundbites, and also we do expect him to kick off a more sensible campaign once he's formally selected for the Republicans. But nevertheless, our vision is that he will not be the winner. Mrs. Clinton will be that, and so we'll have relatively dull and boring succeeding to the next presidency. This is the time when the US dollar will rebound and take the Dow Jones with it. This event plays out on November the 8th, and just like it is with Brexit, those who want to play their hand early could collect some bonanza returns if they guess correctly.
Okay, well, what about the secondary markets? How are you playing that?
Well, bearing in mind what I've said on Brexit, I do think it's worth, for those who have strong conviction on the outcome, only play this if you say, I, in my mind, know which way it's going to come. And as I say, the Beaufort view is Brexit, it will be an in rather than an out. But if you have strong conviction, I would look to play Brexit, both equities and through sterling, both using futures or CFDs. And I think that's something which you want to do sooner rather than later if you have strong conviction, because as we get closer and closer and the opinion polls consolidate, then your prices won't be so good. So make up your mind. Do you think you know which way it's going to go? If so, call your broker up and place something, and I say a future or a CFD, wouldn't be a big bet, and actually your returns could be quite dramatic. That's that. What about special situations in the equity market? Well, I'm going to return to one I spoke about, I think, last time I was on Vox, and certainly I've been talking to the floor of our managers here regularly about it, and that's about the London Stock Exchange. Remember, this one's in merger talks with the Deutsche Börse right now. Now, given that the merged entity will be 55% owned by Deutsche Börse, and that the Deutsche Börse is appointing the chief executive. This clearly is more of a takeover than a merger. And given the rarity of a jewel like the London Stock Exchange, and it is a veritable jewel, those assets, that's not just trading, that's clearing as well, we simply do not believe that the Intercontinental Exchange, the Chicago Mercantile, the Hong Kong Exchange will simply stand by idly and allow this marriage of convenience to go ahead. Now, we know the ICE has already shown its hand, and because the formal merger declaration has been tabled, they now have to either so-called put up or shut up within about 63 weeks. I think it was 53 days after the RNS about the merger detail came out, so 6 weeks or so left to run for that. The others, of course, haven't shown their hand yet. We also don't have a date for the London Stock Exchange's general meeting to get the go-ahead for this deal, but we also believe it would be unrealistic to expect existing shareholders not to demand more. They probably want a cash element in the deal, and they want a revised proposal which gives them more, something which will represent a takeout premium rather than a merger. So, despite the gains we've already seen, it's worked so far for us, and our guys here are smiling about that already, but I'm resisting them when they say they want to take their money off the table. I say hold on in anticipation of a counter bid, a sweetened deal, or both. And the only thing I would paraphrase this by saying is that I would strongly recommend taking your profits off this investment before it goes into a lengthy period of regulatory abeyance, because that could be maybe even as much as 6 months of no news, and you don't want to be exposed to the volatility in the shares as various random rumors come and go during that period. So you could have a bit of a party on the LSE, and we would want to get involved at the current prices. Now, otherwise, if I'm looking for maybe opportunities in the small cap area, one I spoke about last time, MySquare, it's the Burmese or Myanmar social media company. It's been a stunning performer since I last spoke about it, but don't think that's it. There's a lot more to go there. And other determined favorites that I like to repeat regularly, because I genuinely believe in these companies, excellent management, advanced oncotherapy, Motif Bio, a couple of gems in the small AIM space. I think we would also say we want to remain fully weighted in house builders. I've talked about this before, but you're paying eight and a half times forward earnings, tons of visibility, and great yields. I still think they're too cheap. Remember, the UK, irrespective of Brexit, has still got a problem housing its own people. So I think their activity is looking very good for several years to come. And then there's one other that caught my eye. It's a recent IPO, in fact. It's ideal for those who want to play safer domestic yield plays ahead of Brexit. Now, take a look at this one. It was admitted on Wednesday. It's a company called Watkin Jones PLC, and it's a developer of purpose-built student accommodation. It really genuinely has an excellent business plan. I met the management and talked with them at length about this. The beauty of their project is that they effectively forward sell their developments, and they sell them to blue chip entities, and I'm talking about M&G, Legal & General, IAG and so on, who are all desperately hungry for high yielding assets that they create. Now, this kind of model, when you are forward selling, is gorgeous because it limits risk, with negative working capital ensuring that you have exceptional visibility of cash. So it's an obvious winner, given that the UK government is presently, as you have been seeing, limiting a buy-to-let with additional stamp duty, limiting houses of multiple occupation, if I can get my words out, through increased legislation regarding safety and insurance and so on. So purpose-built student accommodation looks to be a winner, and that sector only takes 6.5% of the current 1.7 million students we have in the UK annually. Now, Watkins was admitted to trading with a market cap of £320 million, and I looked at the shareholder register. These are the ones who came in with the IPO, so they are now declarable shareholders, and we're talking quality names beginning to end. We're including Mighton Funds, Schroders, GLG, and BlackRock. And at the moment, It's had 2 days of trading, as I've said. It's trading at a measly 2% above its 100 penny IPO price. And I would say on that basis, you can pick these shares up on the offer, sub 9x forward earnings, with a current annualized yield of 6.5%. I really would recommend building a strong position on this one if you can get it anywhere near the current share price.
Marvellous. And that's, what is it, WJG is the ticker, I think, isn't it?
WJG, exactly right.
Marvellous. Thanks very much, Barry. It's great stuff. Like, do you know what, on the Brexit, I mean, I do have an opinion on this. I would like to see us, in my head, I think it'd be a nice idea to, you know, leave the euro, the eurozone. But the thing is, it's the unknown. And people say, oh, there will be benefits further on down. But how great are those benefits? And is it worth a couple of years disturbing economies, you know, disturbing our economy, just to take that chance? And I think in the end, there's some big employers in this country who are also owned by, you know, European, like BMW and all that, and mm-hmm. you know, and Rolls Royce. And like I said, we've had emails go around, sent to all the employers in these companies saying it will threaten the future of this business. And I think that's enough to make people want to vote to stay in. You know, the uncertainty about their livelihood, their jobs, is enough to, well, you know, even the idea of being alone, I think, away from the eurozone, I think that the practicality of it is it will be a huge upset for the economy in the short to medium term. So that's what people are scared of, you know?
Yeah, I'm 100% with you on it, and I'll admit that I am too frightened myself to say I want out. I can listen to all the fantasy stories about what could come out, but the reality is it ain't any better, and I would inherit a huge bunch of new nerves. The other point is, and I've never quite figured, maybe Mr. Cameron could tell me if he's got a spare moment, but he said there was one vote. It was one vote for in or one vote for out, and it wasn't going to be repeated. My goodness, we're a sovereign state. If we vote for in now, and let's imagine the worst, it won't happen, but let's imagine the worst, in 3 years' time we decide that the EU has not done exactly what it promised, it has not delivered those concessions that Mr. Cameron negotiated, then he can go back during this current tenure for his role as Prime Minister and say, damn it, we'll have another vote. There is nothing to stop us having 2, 3, 5 votes if we wanted. Let's just remind the public that it doesn't have to be now or never. It could be now and again in 3 years' time. And I quite honestly think that's what the Cabinet should propose.
Yeah, I think that will be a vote winner, actually. It's, if you don't like it in 3 years' time, we can go back again. That's brilliant. Barry, have a lovely Easter. Thank you for coming on, and speak soon, hopefully.
Pleasure. All the best.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Chief Executive Officer of Edenville Energy, ticker code EDL. It's Rufus Short. Thank you for coming on, Rufus.
Thank you, Justin. Good afternoon.
Yeah, there's been a lot of, you know, I've been, I won't say hassled, but nudged constantly about Edenville, saying, get them on the podcast. So there's a lot of people out there who know about you, a lot of people invested there. But for people who don't and are not aware of you, what do you do? What does Edenville Energy do, Rufus?
Okay, well, we're an AIM-listed company. We have a project in Tanzania. That is our main project. We hold several licenses in Tanzania. Our main licenses are centered around the Rukwa coal deposit, which is in southwestern Tanzania, near a lake called Lake Rukwa. And we're at a stage now where we've proven up approximately 170 million tons of resource. We've done various steps to take the project forward through licenses and permits and studies. And we're at, I would say, a pre-development stage now. We're ticking those boxes of getting remaining technical work done and remaining negotiations with the government, etc. And ultimately, we want to turn this into not just a coal project, but it will be a coal to power project, where there'll be a mine mouth power station, which will feed off the coal resource for approximately 30 years or 35 years, perhaps. So that's really where we're at, and I can explain more in the interview coming along.
Yeah, okay. So, talk us through, first of all, the size of the resource there.
Okay, well, we have three main deposits in the area called Unkomolo, Namwele and Muze. We've partially drilled Muze, so there's a lot of potential still there. We've drilled a lot more of the Unkomolo and Namwele. The combined resource there is just over 170 million tons. 99% of that is in measured and indicated. So we have the capability there to convert that to reserves, proven and probable reserves. We believe we've got enough coal there for a power station of an acceptable economic and viable size. And the Tanzanians are very, very keen to push forward with that now. So we're at that stage where we've done a lot of work on the project. There are some things still to complete. And please, the next question, so I can lead you into that.
Yeah, well, listen, I've had several questions submitted by private investors. In fact, quite a lot. A lot of them were sort of, replicated, so I've taken them out. But let's start off with a lot of questions about funding. And it says, a question here, how are we planning to fund the mine, given the constant shade dilution? So how is the funding issue being sorted?
Okay, before I start on funding or other subjects, there's one key thing to iterate with this project now. We've recently received our mining license in February after several months of working with the Tanzanian authorities to satisfy all their requirements. And going forward from that, we're also in detailed discussions now with the MEM and TANESCO in Tanzania on ways to develop the power plant. And obviously one of those is a PPA, a power purchase agreement. So there's two key things that have happened in the first quarter of this year: our mining license and the moving forward of the Tanzanian government in their wish to develop this project ultimately into a power project. So those two areas, previously we were waiting on, because these things take time and they can tend to be political and they just take time to go through government sources and whatever. And now we're at this stage where we can really, really move ahead at rapid speed to complete all these other tasks that are needed to be done. And of course, yes, that takes funding. Now, previously, we've funded the PLC. We've tried to be very conservative about the amounts we've taken from funding and tried to target the very essential areas that take minimal cost but maximum benefit, I could say. Now, inevitably, we're talking about stepping up a gear. And we're talking about having to bring in funding at the project level, I believe, and funding from larger institutions, not so much retail shareholders. So we're in discussions with a lot of different groups, and a lot of different groups have expressed increased interest since those licenses got granted and since the Tanzanian government explained that they want to carry on and develop this power station. So we're now talking in detail with groups that have the capacity for both equity funding on a large scale and obviously arranging the debt that is going to be needed for approximately two-thirds of this project.
Okay, and obviously because these are from questions from shareholders, there's the issue of share dilution, and there's a question there saying, are you expected to do any further placings in the next 6 months?
Well, I think in the next 6 months we're going to be fairly well covered for the immediate cash that we need to get projects and parts of the project completed. However, a lot of this depends on how fast the Tanzanian government move with us. And make no mistake, they are pushing this project forward now at a rapid rate, and we are, obviously have to keep up with that. And like I said, this is talking about getting project funding in at the project level. So valuing the project in its in its raw component way, and bringing in funding into Tanzania to ultimately start the construction of the power plant and the mine.
Okay, and there's a question you're saying, I don't know how accurate this is why did we, it's nice they're using the word we, because it's a collective there. So why did we cancel our £5 million facility last year and then dilute the share value?
I presume you're talking about the Darwin facility, Justin?
I'm assuming, yes, that's all the question. There's no more information there. So, £5 million facility last year was cancelled, was it?
We had a Darwin facility that was out there as a possible source of funding, and we viewed it as being something that may have put off various shareholders from investing for certain reasons, and we decided it was better to go to shareholders who at the time were very keen on getting involved and taking shares in the company. So that's the main reason that we cancelled that facility and moved with other shareholders.
Okay.
It's been quite loyal to us.
Yeah. It's a massive project, isn't it? And, huge upside. But timeline-wise, when are you expected to sort of get the mine running and then ultimately, how long will it take to get this power plant up on the timeline, on the horizon there?
Okay, mining. Now, there's various components to the mining. There's preparation works there, and then there's commercial mining. We're starting preparation works on the site very shortly. Hopefully, in quarter two of this year, we will have equipment on site to start constructing basic areas and basic lay down yards for other equipment. And we'll, as far as mining material from the project goes, one of our first jobs is to collect a bulk sample of perhaps 100 or 200 tons, and that will go to test for the wash plant configuration and also for the boiler and furnace configuration in the power plant, all areas that have to be designed prior to the project getting built. Moving on from that, in 18 months we look to be in commercial production, selling to local off-takers of the coal to an extent, but I want to reiterate that the majority of this coal is for the power plant over the next 30 years, and that's very much the government's wish, that this coal is used for that power plant. So there will be a bit of backwards and forwards on that final mining full production scenario, which takes me into the power plant. Now, the power plant phase one, which would be approximately 150 megawatt type operation, would take 2 to 2.5 years of construction time, and then obviously some ramp up into full production. So, say we get a scenario for a year from now where we're looking at starting that construction, we're looking at 3 to 3.5 years and the power plant will be running. So that's the sort of time frames that we're looking at. And it depends on not just engineering. Engineering can really be done as fast as the amount of people you've got working on the job. There's boxes to tick with the environmental compliance that we're working on, and most importantly, it's the government. It's how quickly they want us to push forward with this, and obviously raise the finance for it. But they're very keen on getting this going. The majority of the things in place within the year.
Okay, you'll be producing what in about 18 months, 2 years? Is that right?
Well, coal-wise, we can produce much earlier. But okay. Like I say, there's a you know, there's a trade-off to an extent of how much coal we sell to third parties, and how much coal is there for the power plant, which is the real focus of the project. Mm-hmm. And this is what adds the real value to the project as well, both for us and for the Tanzanian government and ultimately the Tanzanian people. It's about, you know, this project is about, it's a major infrastructure project. It's not just a mining project. It's coal to power, and that electricity is going to satisfy a great shortage of power in Tanzania at the moment. So, you know, we have to work alongside the government with the government master plan on that.
Yeah, there was a couple of questions saying, you know, will you be selling coal locally before the power plant is up and running? And you said limited chances. I think what shareholders are thinking is that you have some intermediary sort of cash flow coming in. Will that be possible?
Yeah, very, very much so, very much so. And I would say that also, you know, the positives behind that is that, you know, we can move forward and refine the mining techniques and you know, refine the way we treat the coal, et cetera, et cetera. In that interim time between now and when the power station starts up. So it will ultimately, hopefully, prove a very smooth transition into the power project when it happens. So, you know, I'm quite positive about the fact that we can move along and sell coal, you know, prior to the power station. I just want to obviously stress the, you know, this is just a strategic project for Tanzania, not just for, which is very good. It gives us, in effect, you know, a 30 to 35 year life on our project, you know, where we know. We know the price of our coal, and we can budget, and it's very much a you know, a steady state production that we can sell coal to the power plants and in the most appropriate arrangement, and we have a ready market, and the power plant has a ready supply of coal. So it's far better than setting up a coal mine with, say, yeah, we've got a year's contract to sell coal to a third-party country, but then after that, where do we sell the coal to and what's the price? So, you know, this is a bit of a different beast to that.
Okay, all right. So next question is, how quickly can EDL progress into power purchase agreements and transmission line agreements?
Okay. Again, we're working with the government on this right now, and these talks are taking place over the next 6 to 12 months. I can't give a timeline to when that's going to finish, but I assure you, you know, we are beginning those discussions. We've begun those discussions now.
Okay.
And So that's where we are.
All right. Next question is, can you explain why EDL is significantly undervalued versus peers, when in fact EDL are now leaders of the pack in Tanzania?
Well, yes. I mean, sometimes this is a mystery to us too. But, you know, we'd like to think we've added pieces of value to the project in the last, you know, 3 to 4 years. We've done that. It's not always been appreciated that we've been trying to put together a fairly complex jigsaw puzzle of pieces. And we've always aimed to do as much as we can so the project can move forward with the government when the time comes. And, I think the time has now come for this project. We have a massively positive reception from the newly formed government in Tanzania, and we are where we are, and it's a stock that is, has great potential. A company and a project that's got great potential.
Okay. And next question, sort of related to that, it says, if EDL has the potential, you say, why haven't the board shown support by taking significant holdings in shares?
Well, again, you know, we've been at a point where a lot of the time we've been working with information that has prevented us to take shareholdings. We very much like to in many instances, but it's just been, we've been privy to inside information, and it's just not been possible. Okay. We would very much like to review that situation now that things are a lot more out in the open with the government and you know how we can progress. We'd like to obviously review that situation and take a deeper part and ownership in the company.
Okay, so essentially you're saying when you're at a closed period, there's a highly likely you will buy some shares, is that right?
I cannot speak for other people, and I don't want to, you know. But I would say we're very keen on participating where we can.
Yeah, cool. Yes. Okay, and next question, two last questions here. With 10 billion shares in issue, when do you plan on consolidation? I mean, I don't know if you are planning on that or not.
I mean, inevitably, that's an awful lot of shares out there, and we need to do something to rectify that. I don't want to comment too much on that, in the public domain at the moment. But we're considering our options for that, and to an extent, it is going to depend on how partner negotiations and funding negotiations for the project eventuate in the next 2 or 3 months.
Yeah,
I would say.
All right, last question is, can you explain why you are the first company to obtain all licenses and permits?
I'd like to say through hard work of our people in Tanzania, actually, and this is both the Edenville staff over there and our consultants, both in Tanzania and overseas. We've had people plugging away at this for a long time now, and also add to that the Tanzanian government, who've been very cooperative and helpful with moving this along, in the way that they have to according to their regulations as well. It's really hard work.
Yeah. Well, hopefully it will all pay off. And listen, if anyone needs convincing, Rufus, could you give us sort of three reasons why an investor should put Edenville Energy on their watch list?
Okay. Well, I mean, the first reason or two reasons, depending on how you'd want to group them, is we have the mining license now, and that's a major de-risking for the project. It moves the project forward where we can supply coal both to third-party users and to the ultimate power project. That's a great achievement, like I say, from our people. And so I'd say that would be the first reason. I'd say the second reason would be the very proactive approach of Tanzania and TANESCO and the MEM to moving their power master plan forward and placing our project as such high importance. And partly I think they're doing that because they realise that we're very serious about this project. We've put in the effort and time to do that. So that's a second reason that we can move the project forward. And the third part is, I would say that, we are in a region that desperately needs power, and our project is strategic in that region. It lies on the line of the north-south power line that's now going through its final feasibility phase and hopefully ready to start construction too. It also lies next to Sumbawanga, which is a regional centre and a source of labour and supplies. And so the whole project is, as a power and a coal project, is very strategically placed. Mm. So that I would say, those are the three reasons I would use.
Yeah, well, listen, you've got a heck of a project there, and obviously with a long-term potential, and you've got sort of lots of news coming out. So listen, Rufus, thank you for coming on, and please do share some more news with us when you next release it.
Oh, we definitely plan to, Justin. I mean, hopefully we'll have lots of updates over the next quarter as we complete all these tasks that we've got to do, and we'll definitely want to share it with our shareholders and the general market out there.
Lovely to speak to you. Speak soon, Rufus.
Yes, thank you, Justin.
That's it for the podcast, and that's it for the trading week, pretty much. So listen, if you do miss the podcast a lot, listen, I've done 442 episodes. And you can just go to voxmarkets.co.uk, follow us blog, have a look for some others. There's also a weekend podcast out with Pete and Steve. A couple of my mates will be talking a couple of things, and we've probably mentioned Asia Met after yesterday. Phenomenal performance from Asia Met. And because we all hold stock in that company. And after the podcast yesterday, amazing reaction to Tony Manini, the main man there, the man, the who's who in the zoo, you know? He talks about the potential upside there of Asian Met, and it's big. Must we talk about that and other things. But listen, have a nice Easter, and thank you very much for listening. And if you do like listening or enjoy it, get some value, please click the link here at foxmarkets.co.uk/blog. Click one of the blogs there. You'll see a link to iTunes. If you can leave me a 5-star rating and review, it'd be much appreciated, and I'll read it out on the podcast.
The Fox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
The people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Don't buy anything based solely on tip or recommendation you hear. Please do your own research.